for questionable reasons. And that went ahead. They were allowed to do that and got away with it, partly because these people don't have the political clout. They don't have the lawyers and so forth that corporations have. There's not a unified group. There are organizations that represent them, but a lot of that has to be channeled through the BIA, and they're not a very effective group up in Alaska. I don't know how they are outside. Another problem with them is that the way these things are handled, the BLM does the application process. They check the claims, and then they do the surveys, and then they turn it over to BIA. But if it's inside a wildlife refuge, Fish and Wildlife gets into it. If it's inside a national park, the National Park Service gets into it, or Forest Service gets into it. And this is all more confusing, and there's squabbling between agencies about who has jurisdiction over these things. And I think it should be one agency. I think BIA should handle the application, they should do the surveys, they should issue the patents, they should handle the whole thing all the way through, so that it's one cohesive program instead of seven or eight different agencies messing around with this and driving people nuts and confusing them. Because they've all got different management styles, they've got, one's real protective and one thinks it's total multiple use, and it doesn't do any good at all for the person who actually owns that allotment. It all does is confuse them, and they don't even know who to deal with. It's the same kind of thing that Sam Demento was talking about. All the initials that these people have to deal with, NPS, BLM, Fish and Wildlife, all that stuff. And the fact that each agency has a different management philosophy, it affects the treatment statewide also. An allotment owner in one part of the state gets handled differently than in another part of the state, depending on the agencies they're dealing with, depending on who the refuge manager is or who the area manager is or that sort of thing. And I think these things deserve a lot more attention than they've gotten in the past. I think because they are individually owned by people, they can get title to this. This is something they can actually hold up and say, this is mine, rather than shares of stock, which is a little more harder for them to understand. And I don't think they should have been repealed. I think people nowadays should be allowed to go out and apply for their own trap lines, whereas they can't. I think that was an unfair part of the act. Now, I don't know why it was done, but I think it was definitely wrong.
We found at the meetings we've held in the villages that this point has come up. People are, some of them at least, apprehensive that their allotments will be lost in 1991. So we have had the opportunity of making it clear that the allotments that Native people hold as individuals are not subject to the 1991 events. Could I ask you a question, Mr. Borecki? When ANCSA was passed, the Allotment Act was repealed as far as Alaska was concerned. Can you tell me why that was done? What was the reason given for doing that at the time?
I don't really know. I don't know why the act was repealed, unless it had something to do with the phrase in there of extinguishing Aboriginal rights. I don't know if that was a tie-in or not. But later in 76, there was a law that repealed the Native Townsite Act also, wherein people could apply for townsite lots. Which were non-taxable and inalienable and held in trust through the BIA also. Now, that law has been repealed, and I think that's unfair also, mm-hmm. Because that opens up Native villages for assimilation, and it removes the opportunity for those people to get their... it removes the opportunity for the next generation to get trust deeds. So it just strikes me as being the whole... the whole thrust is towards removing that trust relationship, which is a long-standing bargain, and that's being phased out, and people are being assimilated, and people are becoming more taxable, and you know, it's one thing to talk about corporate tax structure and that sort of a thing, and then it's another thing to go into individuals and actually subject them to the same kind of uncertainties, especially when they don't understand what's being done to them in the first place. But I don't know why it was done, really.
I see. You still have a Homestead Act in Alaska, you were saying?
Yes.
Well, Native people are eligible under the Homestead Act, I take it.
Yeah, they are, but that's for cultivation of crops and that sort of thing, and it has nothing to do with the Native lifestyle up here.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Waleri,
Hi. My name's Mike Waleri.
Sorry.
It's all right. Everybody mispronounces it. I'm employed by Tanana Chiefs Conference and have been involved in Native issues for a while. However, my appearance here today is not in connection with my employment with Tanana Chiefs. I'd like to share, if I could, a couple of thoughts that I have personally about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and generally with the situation of Alaska Natives currently. In 1971, I was just leaving the state to go outside to receive my education. And I was here going to high school during most of the Claims Act debates in Congress and living in Anchorage, and very casually, I think, looking at the reading the papers, and frankly, at the time, I did not understand what was going on. It seemed to me, and it seemed to most of the people who I lived with, and my friends and family, that it was all a great hoopla over nothing. It was rather difficult for me to understand why Alaska Natives wanted land. It seemed to me to be dredging up things from the past that were dead. But since going outside and seeing some of the developments in the lower 48 with regards to Native people out there, and constantly being asked when I was outside about Alaska Natives and about Alaska, I started thinking about what was really going on in Alaska. And I started looking into it a little bit more and basically got sucked into this huge political quagmire that is sometimes just lumped together as Alaska Native rights and the politics of Alaska. I guess personally I would have to characterize myself as a Native advocate, because what I see happening in Alaska is a rather disturbing thing. 1971, the state of Alaska, at least in as far as I was concerned at the time, was presenting itself to the world as a model of enlightened dealing with indigenous people. This was a bold new experiment which we were embarking upon. This is what the people of Anchorage thought, that this was an honorable, we may not have liked it, but this was an honorable thing to be doing.
Speaking as
a non-native living in Anchorage with very little contact with Native people and with very little contact really with the issues involved with Native people. This is a great experiment. I now wonder to myself, who gave me or gave anybody else the right to experiment with a whole people? And it seems somewhat presumptuous to me now that we would even consider that. But that, I guess, is spilt milk. It was a time, I think, of great experiments. We had in this country a time when we were dealing with the great experiment of liberalism that we called the war on poverty and all of the other related things that accompanied that. It was a time of experiments. It was a time to challenge old ideas and to grasp for something new. And certainly the Alaska Native Land Claims Act seemed at the time to be something new. Looking into it now, I realize that that was wrong, that the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act was nothing unique, nothing new. It was the compilation and aggregation of a lot of worn-out ideas, most of them discarded, with a new veneer of boldness over the top of them. The idea that corporations, natives can be organized in corporations, is nothing really new. We've had it in the United States and since, at least since the Civil War. The idea that natives should not participate as native people in their society, but as shareholders or have a piece of paper to say that they're native, is nothing new. We've had that again since the time of the Civil War and the retributions against the civilized tribes for siding with the Confederacy. The idea that we should settle land claims by leaving a certain amount of land for native people and leaving the rest for essentially non-native settlement is nothing new. It's happened so many times in this country that it's almost a myth. It's almost a fact of our culture. What was new in the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act was a conscious regard for the desire to deal with Native people as in a respectable and honorable fashion, realizing that traditionally that has not been the case in the United States. Maybe that's playing on people's guilt because I think that exploring the way the United States has dealt with Native people historically is so much better than has been the case throughout the world, at least in this century. We don't place bounties on Indians' heads as they have in Brazil. We don't condemn whole tribes to self-genocide as they do in Brazil. We don't engage in active warfare as they do in parts of Central America. We don't deny their indigenous nature as seems to be the problem in Australia. So maybe we aren't as primitive as we like to think of ourselves sometimes, but we are kind of moving into this time when we are examining what's going on in the world and saying that we have to deal as a nation, as the United States, with indigenous people in an honorable and correct way. And in Alaska, that's taken on three great movements. One, the movement to settle land claims. Two, the movement to settle subsistence issues. That is the clash of a subsistence culture with a cash economy. And as we're now moving into the third great settlement, I guess, would be the settlement of the right of Native people to exercise their own self-government as an extension of their own culture and to preserve that right of self-government as a means of preserving culture. That's that as we move into this last great movement, this last great settlement for Alaska Natives, I think we have to be aware that the first two were not completely without controversy, and that as Native people move into this last period, they're looking back over the first two and saying, gee whiz, that's almost what we wanted. That's not quite it. And so there's a lot of soul searching saying, wait a second, maybe this last great thing is also a time to correct some of the deficiencies that we've seen in the past. And I think we're seeing that and hearing that today, and I think you'll hear it wherever you go in terms of your commission. One of the interesting aspects about this whole process is everybody is kind of focusing on structures. As a corporation, the best way to deal with it is stock, a thing to have. Should we have membership corporations? Should we have tribes holding the land? Should we have special associations, which are something new and different as opposed to tribes and corporations? What should be the powers of these structures? That's really not the issue, I don't think. They're nice tools to kind of focus the issues, but the issues are really functional issues. It is inconceivable to me that you could have had anything like the Alaska Native land claims in 1971 and not have the reaction that you're seeing in Alaska in 1980 and 81 and 82 and 83. The simple fact is that that any settlement of Native land claims or any claims, whether it be jurisdictional claims or subsistence claims, the simple fact is that you're changing something, changing one way of doing something to another. And that's going to tick people off, because there's no way to change the Alaska Native people and leave them the same. The simple fact is that any time you engage in settlement, you're going to change what exists. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why the chiefs that met with Wickersham back in the first part of the century in 1906 and 1915 said that they didn't want to change. They wanted to leave things as they were. They didn't want reservations. They didn't want allotments. They didn't want a settlement of land claims because they didn't see anything to be settled. That's a very Native way of looking at things, which tends to say that it's not a very non-Native way of looking at things, which is why, I guess, the settlement came about. But what's happening is a rather interesting set of circumstances. The whole issue of Native status has been coming into question, which is rather curious. And I think it's important to compare, as the 85 study and as the Berger Commission proceed, to take a look at another study that was just recently finished, and that was the review of the Hawaiian Native claims. The Hawaiian Native Commission report is a very interesting document, because it documents quite clearly the way Native claims are settled other than as Indian claims. Basically what happened is the Hawaiian state came into existence by conquest through Kamehameha I, and the nation of Hawaii came into existence and began to engage in international relationships. And there was a tremendous immigration of non-Hawaiians into the Hawaiian Islands, which put pressure upon the Hawaiian government to adopt a non-Hawaiian land tenure system, which they did. But that land tenure, the great division of land in Hawaii, and I can't pronounce the Hawaiian name for it. I'm terrible at other languages. Yeah, well, I think it's called the Great Malili, but I Mahili or whatever it is, and I always have trouble pronouncing it. But the question. What happened there, I think, was that the native people of Hawaii were dealt with outside the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. Their claims, they settled their own land claims with the Great Division of Land in Hawaii under the Hawaiian monarchy. And when the United States annexed the Hawaiian Islands after overthrowing the Hawaiian monarchy, they seceded to the laws of the Hawaiian people, and they recognized fully the laws of the Hawaiian people, including the land laws and the land tenure system set up under the Hawaiian monarchy, which segregated Hawaiian lands into royal lands, non-Hawaiian lands, and the lands that belonged personally to the royal families. The court decisions that followed were pretty clear that the Hawaiian royal lands were seceded in the annexation of the United States. Those went to the United States government. The personal lands of the king, of the royal family, became the Bishop estates, the Campbell estates, the ones that are basically funding many of the social service programs to Hawaiian natives today. And to a lot of non-Hawaiians. For example, I've received benefits from the Bishop estates. One of my children was born in Queen Kapi'olani Hospital in Hawaii, which was set up by the Royal Hawaiian family for the benefit of children, all Hawaiian children in Hawaii. That's an entirely different way than the land claims was settled in Alaska. In Alaska, nobody sat down and asked the Alaska natives to set up a great division of land, to segregate out, prior to the exercise of sovereignty by the United States, how that land was going to be settled, what were going to be the private lands of individuals, what were going to be the public lands of the native nations. Rather, the United States government exercised its power under the Commerce Clause and settled the land claims, providing for consultation with the native groups, obviously, but settled the land claims by act of Congress. The only way they could have done that is under the Commerce Clause of this Constitution. They could not have done it if Alaska Natives were not Indians. And if Alaska Natives are not Indians, then they've got a real gripe. Because what's happened is a huge fraud. And that is that they have had their land stolen in violation of the Constitution. And now they're being told that they do not have the benefits of Indian people. That's a breach of faith, which is monstrous. The United States has to at some time say to itself that Alaska Natives are Indians, and they have the legal rights of Indians.
Excuse me, you mean
Hawaiian? No. The United States has to say to this country, they have to say to Alaska Natives that you are Indians, which is something which is being debated right now. I do not understand that debate. Because if that were the case, the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act is entirely unconstitutional because the Congress has exercised its power outside of the Commerce Clause to deal with people as Indians, to settle their land rights as Indians in a way that they can only do with Indians. I guess the point is that the United States cannot have its cake and eat it too. That if the Land Claim Settlement Act is legal, if it is something that was proper, they could only do that with Indian people under the Commerce Clause. If it was not legal, then what they've done is, if they are not Indians, what they've done is a monstrous fraud. And they should be dealing with Alaskan natives the same way the United States government deals with Hawaiian natives. And that is recognize not their aboriginal title as use and occupancy, mere use and occupancy, but recognize it as full legal title, as the United States did to the Hawaiian natives. You can't have your cake and eat it too. The flip side of that, of course, is that if Alaska Natives, if this land claims was proper, that the United States has a continuing obligation to Alaska Natives, and they have to recognize that fact. And I think that the people of Alaska have to recognize also that there is no discrimination here, because there's been a trade-off. There's been a trade-off because of status, that the way that non-natives basically are allowed to be in this state under American law is because the native people in Alaska have the status of Indians. If they don't have that status, then me and my kids have to go back home.
Could I just interrupt for a minute? Most of the legal materials that I've read say that Congress has certainly treated Alaska Natives in many, many statutes on the same footing as American Indians. Do you, as an attorney, as a well-known attorney in this field, regard the matter as open for debate? You say that there is a debate going on, but can you tell me what your own professional view is?
My professional view is that it's not open for debate. That doesn't stop the debate. The debate is ongoing, and the question, I think, is, and the whole purpose, I think, of this commission, which flows to some degree out of the Claims Act itself, which provides for review in 85 by the United States Congress, raises this whole question of, you know, the status of Alaska Natives, whether or not they have the rights of Indians. And
what do you think they do?
I think it's absolutely clear there's been more than one United States Supreme Court case on it. I mean, the question is absolutely settled. But the question continually raises itself. And I think that those people that raise that question have to be well advised of what they're getting into. Because if the United States can terminate the Alaska Native people, there's no question about that. But there's a moral question out there too. And that is, if they do it without the consent of the Alaska Native people, haven't they broken faith with their own principles? Haven't they broken faith with their own principles, which I think have made this country a fairly decent place to live? And that is that we are a nation of law. We are not ruled by the arbitrary and capricious whims of men. And we may not particularly like the deal that we've struck with Alaska Natives, but unless we're going to radically recognize the full implications of changing that relationship and are willing to negotiate from the ground up again, we've got a problem. The debate is closed, and it's a rather crude form of intimidation to continually bring up that debate and not consider the full consequences of that debate. I guess that's really all I'm saying, and I think it's a moral question at this point. Legally, Congress can do it. Morally, where do they get the right to do that? The other thing I just wanted to talk about was just kind of some questions about the conflicts that I see. Obviously, if you change something as drastically as the Settlement Act has changed Alaska Natives, you're going to see conflicts. I just want to highlight some of the conflicts that I've seen. One of the most interesting conflicts I've seen involves a relationship between the corporations and the people themselves, the shareholders. The since I've been going into the villages and talking to the people, they tell me that the Native people are one. But as a lawyer, I see that that's not the case at all. That what we have are corporations who are, in a legal reality, independent beings with rights and privileges and causes of actions independent of any individual. That's the whole purpose of a corporation. And we see situations where corporations deal with the people in the villages and the people maybe not in the villages, not as one, but as separate. And, for example, we have the case where one corporation is, I don't think it's just one corporation, but we have the question of what about shareholder trespass? How can you have a shareholder trespass against the corporation? I get questions like that all the time.
Against corporation property.
Yes. You know, the shareholder decides he's going to go out and build a cabin like his grandfather did. Goes out there on the corporation lands and builds it, and all of a sudden he's got some lawyer from Anchorage in a slick suit with a piece of paper saying that he's in trespass. That creates some concerns. You have the same problem about timber cutting. If a person has wood on his, if a person's grandfather went out, cut wood and brought it back, why we hear the cry for tribalism and the return to a kind of a unified native existence is that the corporate structure is being fully implemented under the Claims Act. The native corporations and the leadership has really bought into the idea that that corporation is exactly what the law says it is, a separate entity with separate rights, independent of its corporate shareholders. That doesn't mean that the native leadership is necessarily saying, well, you know, we have to do dirt to the natives. All it means is that they're trying to implement what they understand to be the law. The problem is that the law is out of kilter with reality. And that is that native people generally expect to be able to go out and build a cabin on their trap line without having to worry about our dear friend, the slick-suited lawyer. They expect to be able to go out and cut wood on the corporation, on their land, and not have to pay for the privilege to do that. They expect to have the right to go out and operate a trap line in a traditional system and not have the corporation tell them that they have to change that. That they have to change the way in which they do that, or that they have to pay for the privilege of doing that, even if it's a nominal charge. That's part of the problem of change. Is that good? Is it good for the corporations to be doing that? I don't know. Is it bad? I don't know. No, what I do know is that that's a change, and I think that you see a reaction to that, a political reaction within the Native community, and the talk of tribalism because of that. Because of the divorce between native lifestyle and the structures that have been imposed by the Claims Settlement Act. Another real interesting one is the division between the councils and the corporations, especially over 14C lands and townsite lands, the lands right in the guts of the village. I don't know how many times I've been, every time I get to go to a meeting where the corporation and the council meet, I hear this issue. You know, who runs this village? Is it the council or is it the corporation? Traditionally, it's been the council. And before the councils, it was set up under a different system, but basically it was there was leadership in the villages. But now we see the conflict over who controls those lands. Well, the obvious answer is, in most cases, neither one of them control those lands. The corporation doesn't control those lands. The courts have said that those are controlled by the town site trustee and that he may have to give them to the city if there's a city. And the Native Council is out in the cold on the idea, and so is the corporation. The question over 14C lands, which are supposed to go over to the state in trust or to a city, again, the idea of the act was to give
That's
control,
the
1,280 acres in around that surround the village. Those are supposed to, the whole idea of the Claims Act was to settle native land claims and to give native people control over the lands. But how do you settle a land claim when you give land to somebody and then require them to give it to somebody else? Is that, that's stupid. You're not settling anybody's land claims. That's a paper shuffle. And that's all it is.
Mr. Borecki referred to that,
yeah.
Didn't he, as incorporating non-native land in the center of native communities.
Yeah, if the Claims Act was supposed to give native people control over their villages, how in the hell does it achieve it when it takes the guts out of that village and gives the land to somebody else? Now, I happen to be one of those people that subscribe to the conspiracy notion, and maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but the people that I've talked to that were involved in the Claims Act knew exactly what they were doing, and they were afraid. I'm not talking about the native representatives at this point. I'm talking about the non-native representatives, the people representing the Chamber of Commerce and the state of Alaska at the time. The fear and the reason that 14C is in there and that the town sites are there was basically to get that land out of the control of native people because they didn't trust native people to operate those lands to the best interest of the state. And that's reasonable, I guess, if you view that the native interest is different than the interest of the state. But haven't we committed a fraud when we're saying that we're going to give the native people self-determination and control over their lands and we take the guts out of the village and give it to somebody else? It's, again, not a legal question, but a very much of a moral question as to whether or not the United States has met its commitment, its promise of ANCSA in the implementation of ANCSA.
Mr. Borecki said that that land is held in trust by the state. I didn't altogether follow that.
Well, it's not. That's partially correct because the land is technically held. It's either given to a municipality if a city is there, or if the city is not there, it's given to the state to hold in trust for a municipality. And when the municipality is formed, the idea being that native people should go out and organize these cities and encourage municipal incorporation, that then they would be able to get the lands and control of them. The historical fact of municipal incorporation in Alaska has been that municipal incorporation has been a means to disenfranchise the majority of natives living in the village. And I think that most people that have been involved in rural Alaska, with some notable exceptions, for example, in North Slope Borough, but again, you've got a dominance, a substantial numerical dominance of native people in that area. But municipalities in rural Alaska have generally been a means of access for non-natives into the political structure. I mean, even where you have a native community that may be 75% native, non-native control of the municipality is usually the fact. And maybe that's one of the reasons why people complain about 14C. There's some other problems out there, too. Trap lines and fish and game. Traditionally, I think as Mr. George was saying earlier, trap lines are considered a property right. you owned a trap line. There are trap lines, people sell trap lines in rural Alaska. They deal in them. I mean, you pay so much money and that gives you the right to go out and trap. But the state of Alaska and the federal government has never recognized that fact and has always contested that and said no, or there is no such thing as a property right known as a trap line, even though people are in fact paying money for these things and operating them as a property right. The question arises, I guess, is why is that? And again, maybe the issue of tribalism and the idea of native self-government kind of focuses on this as an example and says, hey, the non-native system just ain't doing its thing for the native people because it's not reflecting native life. Similarly, you have the situation of bag limits. Bag limits in rural Alaska are rather silly. If an old person needs meat, he can usually count on somebody coming up with meat and giving and providing it for him. But how does that happen? As a practical matter, it requires somebody to go out and kill two moose, one for himself and one for the other people. It may require him to kill more than two moose. It may require him to kill five moose. If he gets caught doing that, he has violated the law. There's no question about it. But what is he doing in an economic and social sense? For one, he's reducing the dependency of the village on welfare, because if the people do not have those meats that are provided through the subsistence network, they have only one other recourse, especially the older people, because they don't have the ability to go out and earn a living. And there, they do not have our cash retirement system because they've lived in a non-cash economy all their life. So what do? It forces Native people to go out and break the law in order so that they may live their lifestyle and to meet their obligations. I mean, is a young Native person supposed to watch his father reduced to poverty, reduced to food stamps or whatever, and total dependence on the government, or should he recognize his obligations to meet his father's needs? It's a very simple question. I think I know what I would do if I was placed in that situation. Water rights was not addressed in the Claims Act. Just wasn't addressed, and water is a scarce commodity in Alaska, despite all the myths. It's an important commodity. We hear all the jokes about the ice in Alaska, but water that you can use is a scarce commodity in Alaska. It is a vital commodity, and I think that over the next 100 years in Alaska, it is going to be probably the most divisive issue in Alaska is water rights. Who has it? Who has the right, the prior allocations and those types of issues? Water rights were never addressed in the Claims Act, and it's a major and gross oversight. Native people should have the rights in water necessary for them to use their lands, both in the way they have done traditionally and the way they need to use those lands in order to propel themselves into the cash economy. They don't have a choice about going into the cash economy. They're going there. And they need the water secured for that future purpose. If we fail to provide for that, what's going to happen is we're going to have the situation that occurred in Lower 48, and that is that Native people are going to be living in dry, barren areas. Without the ability to provide for their own economic well-being, and that's simply going to be the way it is, and we're going to have a repeat of the past. Finally, one of my kind of favorite subjects, I guess, is children, Indian children. I never thought too much about it when the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in the United States. It seemed to me to be rather a novel, interesting problem. But there is a war that is being waged in the state, a very quiet war, and it's a quiet war because it's being fought in the courtrooms of this state behind closed doors. Children's proceedings in Alaska are confidential proceedings. An attorney can be fined or disbarred for even discussing a case outside of the court, except in certain circumstances. But there's a war going on, I believe, over Indian children. There is the Indian Child Welfare Act, which provides basically, which is designed to preserve as a resource for the native people their children, which seems like a rather curious idea to begin with. But the Congress took a look at the situation and saw that a number of native children were being taken from their families, probably more than should be the case, and saw Alaska as probably one of the most grievous areas of problems with regards to Indian children. Some of those problems have been addressed by the educational system, so that now more Native children are in their villages and can receive their education, don't have to leave the villages, and consequently, because they've left the villages for education, leave the villages for other purposes too, and leave their families, I might add. And so we're starting, that aspect of the problem has been resolved. But still we have the problem that Native ideas of family are entirely different than non-Native ideas of family. Abuse of a child, in my sense, in what I would consider abuse of a child, is substantially different than, or I should say not abuse, but neglect, is substantially different than is the common perception of what is neglect for Native children and in Native culture. I don't know which one is right, I don't. Maybe neither one of them are right. But it is more important. It is more important, I think, to realize that within the Native culture, there's a tremendous amount of love for children, and that there are a number of social problems that make that a very complicated issue. Probably the most important being alcohol and its abuse. There is a question, I guess, that, and there are severe prejudices within the court system, especially within the 4th Judicial District in Alaska, based here in Fairbanks and extending down into Bethel, that Native families are not competent to raise their children once they get into trouble. That Native families cannot be rehabilitated. And that's garbage. Equally as garbage is that the Native society is incapable of dealing with that issue. That's absolute, utter garbage. Native society is quite able to take care of Native children if they are allowed to do so, which means that they have knowledge of the situation, that they have the ability to bring their resources to bear on the situation. But the simple fact that the abuse and neglect of Native children is taken and hidden behind doors in courtrooms far removed from village sites makes it an almost impossible task for the Native people to deal with those issues, because the curative value of the Native family is in the village, generally, even for a person who has been removed from the village for a long time. I've been working with the issue in great frustration for the last 2 years, and the system tends to degenerate Native families. How is a person supposed to catch on to what's happening if they sit through 3 days of trial being told that they are total jerks and don't know how to take care of their children? They become to believe that. How are Native villages supposed to deal with the problem if they do not even, if they are not even allowed access to the child, to even see or talk to the child, that the child is whisked out of the family and whisked out of contact with other Native people. That's a very frustrating system to try and deal in. And maybe Alaska and maybe the resistance of the courts is primarily a kind of a function of prejudice, I think. A kind of a general disregard for the ability of Native people in general, but and for the judgment of Native people. But I think it's important to understand that Native people maybe have the best way of, and I've seen it, when Native people and Native villages are allowed and Native families are allowed to involve themselves with a problem case. I've never seen a case yet that remarkable progress was made when that was allowed. I've seen some other cases where it's not been allowed and some fairly disastrous results. That's basically all I really had to say, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Wallery. Thank you very much. The last name I had on my list this morning is Andy Andre. And I think after Mr. Andre's presentation, we'll break for lunch. Yes.
Yeah, I want to make some comments on your statement about this Alaskan Indians, you know.
All right.
You know, because where is he? Where is he? Did he take off? Did he get scared or what? Did he get scared of
Mr. Wallery, you mean? The last speaker.
Yeah. Did he get scared of an end or what?
He's here.
Well, let him show up. Let him show his face. I'm speaking to not only you, but all you white guys. There's a white guy sitting up right here, too, you know. And all you guys are speaking about this Alaska Native Claims Act, you know, and something like that. But I know one thing, you guys are trying to get into this money, you know, which is probably your get, you know, you're smart enough, you know, you want to get into this dumb Indians, you know, you want to marry these dumb Native girls, you know. Once you get the money, then you're gonna take off, you know, take off like that, you know. Which is true enough for I know for a fact that you guys done it. You guys or some of what guys done it. You guys marry some natives just for their money. Then once you got their money, then you're just gone. Then these poor Native girls are stuck with a kid or a baby or 1 or 2 year old baby, and they're stuck with this. And that's not only that. There's a lot of things. You got their land because you know, once you get that stuff in your name, well, then you're just so. Then you said that the hell with the girl. Hell, I got the money, I got the land, and everything. And so what? Then the poor girl has got nothing to say. She said, "Well, he's my husband, and he left, and he's got everything I got." And see, I've I've been considered as a dumb son of a bitch myself. I've been taught as a I've been taught by one of you white guys. One of you white guys, we were sitting out there. I've been taught to, you know, to fly. I am a pilot with more than 3,000 hours of flying time at Kurtzer Flying Service in Seattle. But afterward, I joined his operating engineers local 302 as a professional operator. And now I am a professional operating engineer, and I couldn't go to work now because when I go to my union down at 302, they said they all say they this Bert or I'll say, we haven't got an opening, you know. And that's how they treat an Indian. See, that's how you guys treat an Indian. You white guys. You too. That's how you treat an Alaska Native. I'm talking to you. You white guys, that's how you guys treat an Indian or an Alaska Native. You know, man, you say you give this Alaska Natives good treatment. That's a bunch of baloney. That's a bunch of baloney, boy. That's just a bunch of baloney as far as I'm concerned. I better not talk too much because you guys are going to call the police, you know, or something. You guys are going to call the police. That's where you guys are going to call the police and say, Andy's raising hell on you.
All right, thanks.
I better not say no more.
I'm not going to call the police, but I think I'll go to lunch.
Go to lunch? That's a good excuse, sure. Well, I got to go to lunch. That goes for me, too.
To what time should we adjourn, Mary? When should... 2 o'clock? All right, we'll adjourn till 2 o'clock and look forward to seeing you then. Thanks very much.
How about giving me your name, and I'll give me your name and address and phone number, and I'll get somebody to phone you about it.
Great. Do I need to know that?
Just put your name.